Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It's displaced people from the houses who have been damaged, roofs gone down, or they can't get into the house, or police have evacuated certain areas of Christchurch.
Get your priceless possessions out of your house, put them in your car, and go to a safer place where there's plumbing, power.
Now it's just a matter of adjusting to the day-to-day business of dealing with no sewerage, no power, and no water.
The one thing I'm never going to forget is standing out here and seeing a guy carrying his little baby in his arms and the look on his face, and you could just see the tears coming down. And the wife, they were just numb, the pair of them, and I was looking at them thinking, this is worse than a war. It's just too much. Sorry, I've had it.
What happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, can happen here. It will happen on BC's west coast. In our scenarios, it has happened. And it's been 1 week since then. As our last episode came to a close, the true scale of the disaster was beginning to come into focus. And one of the greatest issues now facing the south coast is the sheer number of displaced people. We're talking tens of thousands of residents unable to return home. For emergency officials, this will now be top of mind. A week after the event, we're still very much in the life-saving phase. Search and rescue teams continue to work around the clock, scouring the rubble with dogs and heat-sensing technology, hoping to find survivors who have been trapped since the earthquake. But time is running out. Rescue will become recovery. Some communities have still not been reached at all. People who were out hiking in the backcountry remain stranded, their paths blocked by landslides. Those who live far from their nearest neighbors, far from key transportation routes, are very much alone as they wait for help to arrive. After the megathrust earthquake, Port Alberni and Tofino have been completely cut off, inundated by the tsunami. There is nowhere for boats to dock or planes to land, so contract helicopters are the only way in and out. Municipalities on the North Shore use tugboats and barges to move supplies as engineers continue to assess the bridges. It takes a monumental effort of coordination between a number of logistics teams to make this happen. There are other issues now, too. Dealing with our dead. Concerns about illness as we camp in close quarters with no access to running water or sewage. There has been some minor looting, but reports of violence are exaggerated. This catastrophe has brought us closer as a community. It doesn't take long for us to understand what being in this together really means. I'm CBC Vancouver seismologist Johanna Wagstaff, and this is Fault Lines, a podcast about how we on the southwest coast of Canada will survive a major earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. This is episode 4, 1 week, a new normal. We've survived the devastating event that's threatened our region forever, but how many of us are prepared to survive for this long on our own? A week in and supplies have all but run out. Which of us now rely on our community, neighbors, strangers, to share valuable resources? Something as simple as being stuck at work in high heels, as hindering as not having eyeglasses once your contact lenses dry up, or as dire as not knowing how to find your child after sending them off to a soccer game just hours before the quake hit. All of this leaves us vulnerable and looking for help.
So I have not only emergency supply kits at home, I have an emergency supply kit in my car.
I decided it would be a good idea in my office to have a pair of running shoes. There was a minimum kit. So I have running shoes, I have some food.
The government tagline of, you know, be ready for 72 hours is just not enough for me to feel good. So my kit's about a 2 week, maybe plus kit.
We need you to be prepared. We're going to do everything we can. You also have a responsibility, though.
And while we're struggling to make sense of our lives now, emergency officials are working to get major infrastructure back online. Power, water, sewage, main transportation routes. But it all takes time. The community of Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island has been one of the hardest hit. Those who have survived are now being accounted for, but many are injured and unsure of where to go. Mayor Josie Osborne.
It's really difficult to say what to expect within the first week, but you would hope that by the end of that first week, you've got all of your major systems internally, not systems as in, we know we're going to lose water, electricity, sewer, all of those kinds of things, but that we've got a system in place where we're able to triage and do immediate damage assessments, look at buildings that determine where it is safe to go and not to go, ensure that those who can take care of themselves are able to take care of themselves while we focus our efforts on the people who need the most help. I mean, we know that it'll be tens of thousands of people across the region. So here in Tofino, difficult to say.
And in the major centers like Vancouver, it could be a while yet before basic services are restored. Daniel Stevens is the city's director of emergency management.
When we're looking at people who have been inconvenienced or who don't have access to a bathroom or, you know, the sewage system is damaged in their area, we will do our best to get in, and we have plans to get in sewer systems to both repair the system but also provide alternate means, you know, portable shower facilities, portable toilets, that type of thing. But it's going to take time for those to be deployed, and I think 10 days is not unreasonable to look at to cover the area. It'll be phased in, but we won't be able to get to every area immediately.
Children who survived the collapse of their school, children who were separated from their parents by broken roads and bridges, they've now been reunited with their families. And as those families wait for help to arrive, new routines are established. Normalization becomes the focus, even if normal doesn't exist anymore.
You know, in the recovery, we're looking at getting the supports in place to get the community back on its feet. So school systems, people, you know, getting their children be able to get back into school so that they can receive some level of normality and also allow their parents, who many of them have been, all of them who have been impacted in the earthquake, many of them who may actually be responding to the earthquake and doing things to get the community back on its feet. Getting the schools back up together is a really critical piece to that long-term recovery. Our libraries, our community centers, some of those will be needed in the initial response. They may be taken over for a different use, and the day-to-day use of the library or the community center may not be available to the community. But that's a big deal to many people in terms of returning to normality and or the new normal, as it will likely be after an earthquake.
Emergency response teams have been at it for 7 straight days. No level of practice or field experience has prepared them for the emotional trauma of seeing their own community as a disaster zone, of being victims themselves. At the end of every shift, they check in with one another, talking through trauma, preparing themselves for another day. The BC Yukon Division of the Red Cross is among the local teams working nonstop, helping set up shelter and delivering first aid through outreach and field hospitals. It's a role they'll continue to fill as we move past this first week. But because I think of the Red Cross as an emergency response organization, I wondered where their focus will be as we're beginning to transition into recovery. So I called up Vice President Kimberly Nimrava.
The priorities shift to community building. They shift to building back better. We work very closely with the community to say, what is it that you need? Where are the gaps that you're finding? How can we support you? And so it will look a little bit different for each disaster, but generally it comes under 4 big categories: support to individuals and families, support to the community, and that may often be funding other community agencies. If there's a food bank in the community and we've been raising some funds, rather than setting up a separate infrastructure to help distribute food, we will simply give money to the local food bank because they've already got the infrastructure set up. So we support community agencies, we support small businesses in their recovery, and then we also support the community in preparing for the next disaster.
Getting small businesses back up and running, building community resilience for when the next disaster hits, these are important steps towards recovery. And so is getting people home. People who just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Aid is now pouring in from around the world, delivered by planes that then carry stranded visitors out of the disaster zone. And getting people out is a process that could take weeks, according to Sean Carby, Senior Manager of Protective Services with the Capital Regional District in Victoria.
We're going to barely be able to look after ourselves versus being able to deal with repatriating individuals. So they will become part of the displaced persons. We'll have locally displaced persons, and some of the displaced persons will be tourists, visitors from other parts of Canada, other parts of the island, other parts of the mainland that just happen to have been caught at the wrong time. And as resources become available to start looking at repatriation, then it may be that that'll begin. You may see that with supply aircraft coming in full, but maybe going out with individuals that either need medical care, further attention, or are need to be repatriated to their home countries or other areas.
But for the millions of people who call the disaster zone home, this is it. There is no flight out of here. We've survived, but we've got a long way to go on this journey towards recovery. In the days and weeks after the 2011 Christchurch, New Zealand earthquake, teams of engineers inspected the 3,000 buildings in the city's downtown core, and yellow or red tagged 45% of them because of safety issues. By February 2015, 1,240 of those buildings had been torn down, almost half. Of all the cities around the world to experience major earthquakes in recent years, Christchurch is perhaps the closest example of what we could expect here in BC. Not only do we share similar soil conditions, we share similar construction techniques and materials, as well as building codes. Every engineer tells us the same thing. Look at what happened in Christchurch, and expect the same here. Yes, the majority of our buildings will stay standing during the event, but too many of them will be red-tagged after the fact, unsafe. Which means our municipalities, the province, they now have to figure out what to do with the incredible numbers of us who now have nowhere to live. Emergency Management BC Executive Director Heather Lyle lays it all out for us.
Very likely, if we were to have a significant earthquake, we could definitely have in the tens of thousands of people displaced. And, you know, people don't want to go too far from their home, so that's also a major challenge for us. What's left to house them? You've seen what it's like on a daily basis here, where our real estate market to our, you know, our major tourist location. So, you know, right now, a good part of our emergency plans for just even a fairly significant fire, an apartment building fire, typically we would place those people that are displaced from that apartment building into a hotel. We had to look at what we call group lodging, and we know in a catastrophic earthquake that is what we're going to be faced with, is your large gymnasiums, your churches, your community centers, you know, mass care where everybody's going to be all in the one room, and we're going to do our best to plan out for dignity and respect amongst everyone, but you know, there's a very real chance that you're going to be sleeping on a cot in a gymnasium for anywhere from days to weeks to potentially even months, depending on how long it takes to bring in some trailers, bring in alternate means, or also move vulnerable populations out where we may have to be faced to do that.
Gymnasiums, churches, community centers, trailers. This is where many of us are now living. It's worth noting that Vancouver is twice the size of Christchurch, and that's just the urban core. If you add the rest of Metro Vancouver, we're seven times the size of Christchurch. As for our density, take Christchurch and multiply by a factor of 20. So back to those building codes. We know we should expect and prepare to be on our own for at least a week, if not 10 days. That's the first big takeaway. The second, our building codes are only good for one thing. Remember Perry Adbar with UBC's Department of Civil Engineering?
That's really the big problem, is our building code is written so that engineers will design buildings that will ensure life safety, that'll prevent collapse. So the chance of you getting badly hurt will be very low. But the building code doesn't ensure that a building can be usable after an earthquake. So there will be many buildings that will be unusable, and people will have to, in fact, they'll leave the building safely and perhaps never re-enter.
Do we have any idea or concept in Vancouver how many of those buildings will likely not be livable afterwards?
It's difficult to estimate. Again, it depends on not just the magnitude of the earthquake, but how close the earthquake is to the city. So, for example, if we had a smaller size earthquake but quite close to the city, then we could have a large number of buildings that are badly damaged. Many buildings, again, will do well, but quite a few will be badly damaged.
The building codes are just that they stay standing, and do they take into account aftershocks at all?
No, not really. We designed for essentially the main event. So aftershocks are a bit of a concern. So you have a main earthquake, and then you'll have aftershocks after that. The aftershocks will be smaller, usually. But the concern will be that if a building is damaged during the main event, we're not sure what will happen during an aftershock. So it's actually the aftershocks that are one of the reasons that buildings tend to have to be vacated, because if a building's damaged, it's very difficult for an engineer to say, yes, this building will be safe in a significant aftershock. So the fact that we get aftershocks after the earthquake is one of the reasons why damaged buildings are uninhabitable.
On that last point, engineers are divided. But Perry Adbar estimates as many as 100,000 people may be left homeless in the Lower Mainland area alone. As for the aftershocks that may or may not push our buildings over the edge, a week after the main event, the ground still shakes. In order to be considered an aftershock, it has to be smaller than the original earthquake, but that doesn't necessarily mean it won't inflict damage. In fact, that magnitude 6.3 earthquake in Christchurch we keep talking about, yeah, that was actually an aftershock. The main event was a magnitude 7.1, and it happened almost 5 months earlier. That one was 40 kilometers from Christchurch. It was about 17 times stronger than the aftershock, but no one died. Christchurch did experience severe shaking for about 40 seconds. Sewer and water lines were damaged, and the water supply was contaminated for weeks. The 6.3 aftershock struck only 10 kilometers from Christchurch. Yes, some buildings had been weakened by the original earthquake, but it was the shaking from the shallow and much closer aftershock that caused the real devastation. And that is why scientists who study this stuff are so worried about a crustal earthquake near Vancouver, Victoria. If it's the megathrust that hits first, we can expect aftershocks. Most will happen well off the coast of Vancouver Island, along the boundary between the two plates that slipped. In fact, over time, the aftershocks will reveal just how much of the Earth actually moved. In our megathrust scenario, aftershocks will reveal a rectangle roughly 500 kilometers by 50 kilometers by 10 meters. The aftershocks will be felt across the south coast for weeks, even months to come, as was the case in Christchurch. So we kind of have a perfect case study for what could happen to Vancouver. It's given engineers a pretty good sense of what will happen to our own building stock. And it's not just the older buildings we need to worry about. Here's Perry Adbar again.
Every time the building code comes out, the earthquake requirements are tightened. They're stricter. We know that the earthquakes could be bigger. We know how to design buildings better. So there's generally a belief that the older the building, the worse it'll do. But I don't agree with that. I've looked at drawings of older buildings. And we have wonderful buildings that are built in the 60s that will do very well. On the other hand, we have brand new buildings being built now, which won't collapse, but I'm pretty certain will be badly damaged, even though they're brand new.
Here in Metro Vancouver, Adbar figures the single-family homes, at least those built on solid ground, will fare well. But in Victoria, it's another picture altogether. Seismic engineer and school retrofit pioneer Graham Taylor took us for a drive.
In 700 meters, turn right onto Fiskort Street.
We parked in front of a typical wood frame house, built in the 1920s or 30s on unstable land, much like what they've got in Christchurch.
The top part of the house, the top two stories, it won't move. It's so heavy, the basement walls are so weak that it won't move the top part of the house. So the top part of the house sits there. So it's base isolated. But the trouble with the basement walls is the top of the basement wall is staying with the top of the house and not moving. The bottom of the basement wall, the wood frame wall, connected to the foundation wall, is moving with the ground. So that shearing action, which can be anywhere from 10 centimeters to 20 centimeters, depending upon what the soil is going to peel off the outside old stucco. The horizontal boards are going to get weak. It's going to get floppy. So let's say that's in the first 5 seconds. And we've got another 30 seconds to go. So what's going to happen is get weaker and weaker, and as soon as the movement, when it starts to get floppy, as soon as the movement is more than the thickness of the stud, it's going to collapse. The studs are only 40 millimeters thick. So what it means is at the beginning, the house is standing because it's still damaging the outside sheeting and the inside finish, So in a crustal event, it's still going to be standing. In a subduction event, it's weakened the outside that started to damage it, and now it's going to work at it for another 20, 30 seconds. That basement's going to collapse.
Taylor envisions 70 to 80% of Victoria's housing stock disappearing this very way.
It begins where we live, and half of our entire country's infrastructure is invested in that. And a brand new house that's being built today, maybe not collapse, but it will definitely be red tagged. The red tag issue is the skeleton in the closet. And that's the one we are totally unprepared for. And that's the one that's going to exacerbate the problem we have.
So let's talk about red tagging. As mentioned, teams of engineers are now fanning out across the province to check buildings with green, yellow, and red tags in hand. And if your home gets a red tag, you're not going to be living there again. At least not until someone's had a chance to give it a more thorough investigation. But both Graham Taylor and Perry Adbar have their reservations about whether we've actually got the expertise we'll need to determine what's safe and what isn't. And that only compounds the problem. Yeah, I mean, I have no concept how many engineers it would take to inspect a whole city. I mean, do we even have that capacity? And I mean, can any structural engineer inspect a building afterwards? Is there a rule book to follow?
No, there isn't. And it's actually a very challenging issue. And again, it comes back to most engineers aren't really going to have the experience and the knowledge to be able to make an accurate assessment. So they're going to err on the side of caution. If you're not certain this building is safe, are you going to tell people, yes, it's safe to go back in? We may have thousands of buildings that are not actually that badly damaged, but we don't actually have the people with the ability to say, yes, this building is safe in the aftershocks. You know, it's these 10% of the buildings that are unsafe. So again, what does that do? It increases the chance you will not be able to go back into your building because somebody has said this one may be unsafe.
So what's the solution? According to the engineers we spoke with, it's a combination of things. More training, better training, and maybe something that forces us to take resiliency seriously.
In fact, you might say the best thing that could happen to our area is a small earthquake that damages a few buildings, doesn't hurt anybody, and everyone will start to realize, yes, this is real. This could really happen.
Unfortunately, in our scenario, it's too late for that. And we're now facing a crisis. Where to put tens of thousands of displaced people? This is when it becomes clear just how important it is to build some normality into our lives. This is when people will begin to think of returning to work, returning to school, even if it means working and learning from a tent. 5 years after its own disaster, Christchurch is still recovering, and many expect it could take 50 years to get the city back to where it was before the earthquake. Two full generations. How long will it take here? Seismic engineer Graham Taylor.
It's a disaster in slow motion. Every disaster has five or six contributing factors, and this is not pointing the finger at government, it's all of us. All of the factors are contributing to the fact that we're going to have a $100 billion economic loss. You know, 2,000 to 3,000 people being killed, over 100,000 people displaced, and Christchurch, they're talking about maybe 3 to 4 decades before it recovers. That'll be the same for here, let alone the effect on the Canadian economy, and the whole Western gateway to Asia is closed.
On the next episode of Fault Lines, taking back our future and learning from the past, how we fare a month, a year, or more later, and the ultimate survivor tips from those who have been there. I'm CBC seismologist Johanna Wagstaff. For more episodes of Fault Lines, you can find them all right now at cbc.ca/podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, we would really appreciate you taking the time to write us a review. Join me next time as we come face to face with our own fault lines and our own responsibilities.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.